Welcome, Register Readers!
Welcome, Register Readers, to episode 17 of Open Season. As always, we have the faithful crew of Matt Acey and Dave Rosenberg on the line. And this week, we're also joined by Mike Olson, CEO of Sleepy Cat, and then a bigwig at Oracle before bailing out for a life of leisure. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Hey guys, it's good to be here.
Rich entrepreneur. A rich entrepreneur is on the phone, and it's not Matt or I.
I was trying to put subliminal messages in there.
Well, we've got a action-packed series of show notes here. It looks like a lot of griping is in order. Maybe since Mike might have to duck out, let's start by just checking in. Mike, what are you doing these days?
As little as I possibly can. That turns out to be a little bit more than I'd like. But, you know, I'm mostly taking it easy. I'm getting lots of biking and hiking and diving and, until recently, skiing in, hanging out with the kids and my wife, and all that's nice. And then in my copious spare time, I'm visiting some companies and talking to VCs and entrepreneurs to try to figure out what I should do next. Matt, I guess, blogged a week ago, that I was looking for a job, and that got the phone ringing pretty hard. So, Matthew, thank you for eating into my free time.
I just want 15% of whatever your first year salary is.
All future earnings. Don't just take first year.
Matt,
it's
I really
a subscription
think
basis. That's true.
You need absolutely to offer to set up a placement firm, because not long after your blog post up, the phone rang for 2 days.
Look at that, the power of Matt Acey.
I actually felt kind of bad because the firm that I heard about it from, the company that you were talking to, I kind of worried that maybe I was going to end up, somebody else was going to call you and you weren't going to go join them, if indeed you were planning to join them. So I actually apologize and repent in sackcloth and ashes.
Well, it's good. Then that's going all around. The person who talked to you about me called me up to apologize for having done that. So now everybody but me is sorry. And actually, I'm pleased to tell you that I couldn't figure out who you had talked to, because I've been talking to lots of guys lately. But I'm still pretty resolute. I'm not planning to take a job before the end of the summer. We got a bunch of family stuff planned, and I got a couple of kids who are getting older, getting ready to go away to college. So I'm looking forward to spending some time with those guys.
You know, it looks like that Yahoo CEO gig might open up here pretty soon.
Yeah, that'd be a good place to be, wouldn't it?
Well, with Bomber after blowing the whole acquisition, maybe that one will be open too.
There you go, Mike Olson.
Well, I just can't wait for Carl Icahn to call me. That would be a great day.
So, Mike, one thing I wanted to make sure we got to before you left, or I forgot, was the Jim Gray tribute that's coming up at Berkeley. It's at the end of this month.
Yeah, that's right. It's May 31st. For those of your listeners who don't remember, late January last year, Jim Gray, who's a very well-known and widely respected database researcher, got on his sailboat in the San Francisco Marina and planned a trip out to the Farallones Islands. His goal was to drop his mother's ashes at sea. He sailed away in the morning and never returned. Short story is that he just disappeared altogether. Jim had a lot of well-connected and technologically sophisticated friends, and a large group of us launched kind of an amateur search to supplement the Coast Guard search for Jim. We used satellite imagery and NASA ER2 aircraft imagery and drift modeling and a lot of advanced scientific techniques to try to figure out where he might be. Amazon Mechanical Turk factored in. There were volunteers from around the world in every major research and commercial company you can think of. But after nearly a month of looking, we found no sign of him at all. He just totally disappeared. So that was disappointing. We stood down the search. The family continued to look for him for a while. They even went so far as to search the seafloor with sonar and cameras to see if they could find any wreckage of the boat. Likewise, nothing turned up. His family has set up and will be hosting a tribute event to Jim in Berkeley on May 31st, and maybe 700-800 people are registered right now to come to that. If you knew Jim, if you liked him, and if you'll be in the area, please join us. It's a public event, and you can learn more on the web. Probably the simplest thing is just Google the Jim Gray Tribute, and Gray is G-R-A-Y. It's a little bit sad, but I'm looking forward to seeing everybody and having a chance to reconnect.
Yeah, I'll put a link in to the website and also the register we're covering. We'll be covering the day as well. So obviously Jim Gray was...
Ashley, are you going
to
be there?
You know what? I would love to be there. I'm going to be out of town, but Cade Metz is going for us. So
yeah, have Cade look me up. I'd be glad to meet him.
Okay, that's great. So anyway, I mean, Jim was just a legend, and so it's a well-deserved day. You went to Berkeley, right, Mike?
I did, yeah, and I still live in Berkeley.
Right. So on the lighter news, perhaps, you I saw there was also a note you wanted to maybe talk about the OLPC kind of looking like it's definitely going through some throws here. There was
not going through throws. It just passed the virility test.
What is that test exactly, Matthew?
That's Negroponte. He just said being able to run Windows makes people think that we've passed a virility test. It was one of the most interesting and idiotic quotes I've heard in some time. Because I know lots of hardware that'll run Windows, and I've never necessarily thought it made anybody more or less of a man. But there you go.
What's your take on what's going on, Mike?
You know, in my other spare time, I'm working with a group right now called Literacy Bridge. Literacybridge.org is the URL for the organization. And this group has a very different approach than the OLPC effort at sort of promoting literacy and learning in developing economies. I'm excited about it. It is based on much cheaper hardware and a much more peer-to-peer model. I tell you guys, and I've thought this from the very beginning, I think OLPC is the worst kind of charity. It's a bunch of rich Westerners foisting expensive and hard to maintain devices on developing economies where they're really unsustainable. I mean, you know, first, I don't believe that the biggest problem in the world is that students in classrooms in rural Africa don't have good computers and can't learn to program. I think the problem to solve is these guys need to learn to read. The budgets for these, the education budgets in these countries are way too low to permit the government or anybody else to buy these devices. I just think that a bunch of technologists in the Western world thought of a device that they thought was kind of cool and came up with a use case that's not tied to the real needs of the communities in which they'd be deployed. So I'm not surprised that it's not getting taken up by customers in the way that people had hoped. And, you know, I predict that that's going to continue until they find a use case that people care about.
You know, so that's actually an interesting point, because I think I agree with you, Mike. I mean, so, like, for example, through my own preferred charity is an education fund that goes to developing nations where it funds people to go to school and whatnot. So I think that has far more value than whether or not somebody has a laptop. The thing that kind of bothers me in all of this is that, so absolutely agree, if Negroponte and the one laptop per child people thought that what they were doing was providing not cheap laptops, but laptops that would encourage the next generation of hackers so that they could go out. I mean, these kids, I think, are like grade school kids. They're not going to be writing software. So the fact that it's open source probably doesn't matter. But I think OLPC really did itself and did the world a disservice by acting like it mattered. And now Negroponte comes out in an interview in this past week saying, you know, open source was a necessary way for us to start so that we could basically borrow everybody else's labor, but Windows is probably the way for us to go because that's what everybody likes to use. Yeah, I think he's just kind of making up stuff as he goes along trying to revise history. But I would agree with you that if in fact we measure it in terms of what it was, what would actually help the developing world, it's probably not cheap laptops. It's probably literacy. It's probably education. It's probably a lot of other more basic things.
The other thing, too.
I think that's right. And if somebody's going to invest that money, it ought to be invested in the problems that are easiest to solve. I mean, cynically, guys, I think this was a lot more about Nicholas Negroponte than it ever was about students or even about technology.
I was just going to say, I mean, this guy seems to have an amazing ability to alienate people who might potentially help out with this program. I mean, it seemed like he had finally coerced Intel into backing it, and then seemed to be such a dick that, you know, even Intel took the PR hit of backing out, which is, you know, Intel could have at least just plodded along if he wasn't so grating.
Well, and if you look at some of the other things that are out in the universe, like, I mean, there's lots of inventions that create clean water and do all these other things, electricity, all the really basic necessities, and instead we're trying to figure out how do we make a better crank on a laptop that no one's ever going to really know what to do with.
So that raises,
stay tuned. I think that, you know, I think that this story doesn't get a lot better for the Media Lab and the OLPC. I think it's a problem. I think it's a solution that has no problem.
So actually that raises the interesting point that I think I already know what everybody on this call, including myself, will say is in response. Does that mean that Bill Gates is actually a much more benevolent philanthropist than Nicholas Negroponte ever hoped to be?
Yes.
Yes.
I think
so.
Gates Foundation is awesome. It's too bad it's coming from there's still like, you know, that massive force of evil. But the money that they have and the things that they're trying to do are truly, you know, changing the world.
Are they? I'm still waiting to see.
Well, I mean, you know,
they're trying to wipe out
AIDS in Africa versus give everybody a laptop. You have to give them at least some credit for that.
No, their intentions seem good. It just seems that anytime, what are they doling out? Is it $1 or $3 billion a year? I mean, good Lord, you know.
I think it's more. Well, didn't they just put Jeff Rakes in charge of that?
Right.
So, I mean, you know, maybe that makes it better. But, you know, but I do think, Matt, that you're probably right. The sentiment is that the Gates Foundation seems to have slightly better intentions. As to whether or not they can execute on them is a whole different thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
I read a biography some time ago of John D. Rockefeller. I think it was called Titan. And, you know, Rockefeller was the first Gates-like personality in the U.S., and he really invented this idea of responsible philanthropy and measuring results and doling out money in tranches in order to keep people focused. And say what you will about where the Gates Foundation money came from, however you feel about that, I do think that it's professionally run and it's directed with an eye to results, and I think that that's the way philanthropy ought to be. I'm a big fan of the Gates Foundation. I think they're tremendous, and I'm sure that they're doing tons of good work that we don't know anything about.
Speaking of philanthropy, what about CBS buying CNET this week?
That was awfully nice of them. Yeah.
Are you thinking that was Was that a philanthropical discussion?
Well, you know,
I immediately started sending out emails to see if somebody else would hire me.
I immediately asked if I could get Letterman tickets. I swear to God, the first thing I did was my editor.
What does this mean?
She's trying to get on Guiding Light, which is pretty funny. So,
what do you guys think about this? Is it just CBS trying to get a big in on the web and make? I mean.
I mean, CNET owns a lot of properties that none of us know about and that they don't use. I mean, they own, like, you know, kids.com and things like that, like all these domains and all these properties, and they have a publishing infrastructure. I mean, the problem is that they just went so sideways with some of that weird consumer crap. And CBS has infinitely more money and theoretically should be able to do a lot more. I don't think it helps or hurts us on the blog side unless CBS decides to take news.com, which is a possibility.
Yeah, but is it? I mean,
they could probably do whatever they want.
I can speak here because I don't think anybody from CNET actually listens to this. But TechCrunch made the point that CNET it's too little too late on the blogging side, that CNET Discover. And I actually kind of feel this way sometimes on, you'll notice, Dave, I'm sure, that the posts that get cross-posted on CNET, your posts, I mean, they're certainly true of mine, the more boring they are and more newsy, the more likely they are to get cross-posted. If it's commentary that I actually think is interesting, it's less likely to get
posted. Yeah, I mean, if I do something on, like, I did the missile command. Do you see that awesome touchscreen missile command somebody did? I had a YouTube video, and it was, you know, three lines of text that got cross-posted in three different sites and got enormous traffic.
Yeah.
Do you guys think that acquisition was about access to these new media channels, or do you think that CBS is looking for ways to distribute its video content and this is kind of a rear guard action against iTunes?
Well, that's what some people are arguing, because CNET has, like Dave was saying, they have the TV.com domain, right? And obviously they've been pushing the video stuff forward for a while, so it just seems like it's a way for them to kind of up their tech savvy, I guess. to some degree.
Well, and we've all learned from Microsoft that what you do is you go ingest some web savvy rather than develop it at home, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Try to buy Yahoo.
I mean, I don't know. You think about it, they've got a CNET has a good stable of advertisers. It has content that could be leveraged across multiple properties. That it's just, I don't know. I would say that my take on CNET has been that there's all a lot of really valuable stuff, but you don't necessarily know about it, and they haven't been able to work it through because the strategy has been not always clear.
It's going to fail.
Well, I got to say, Matt, Dave, as insiders, you guys are useless. We were really hoping for the skinny on what was happening in the boardroom, and you guys have failed us.
I think it would be a lot worse if CNET had a proxy fight. And, you know, it may be better, it may be worse, and you'd probably get a lot more sites about it. But, I mean, at this point, consolidation has reached a level of absurdity. I was going to blog about this, but then I figured no one would read it, so I'll give it to, like, a real publication. But this consolidation in everything has reached a point of where TechCrunch is probably right, that somebody needs to aggregate some of these things and make it better. But, like, if you look at software at this point, we're now stifling innovation with the level of acquisitions. And if TIBCO gets taken out, there's no more I'm just using my area as an example, but there's no more middleware, right? After TIBCO gets taken out and Oracle buys them or whoever, some other big company, it's really reducing customer choice, and it's going to create a real problem in the market because all the other companies are sub $100 million.
So, Mike, what do you think of that as one of the first sellouts?
I wasn't paying attention when Dave was talking. I was setting up text messages.
No one pays attention. That hurts.
Industry consolidation, ruining customer choice, sleepy cat, the first to go. What do you think?
No middleware left.
Well, you know, I think Sleepy Cat did Mule and Alfresco a favor in establishing in the venture community that there was a market for open source.
Yes. No, Mike, before you proceed, let's be clear. We absolutely want to be consolidated, but we're worried about customer choice after we're consolidated.
That's just me and Matt, though. Screw everybody else. I need that giant.
I think your fears are overblown.
Really?
Big companies can run many different product lines and many different projects. And I think that, you know, our experience at Sleepy Cat was that we could keep doing the stuff that we wanted to do. And, you know, I don't think that the well of innovation dries up when the current round of companies get bought. You know, a lot of people are going to be looking for their next gigs and figuring out what they're going to do next. And customers will continue to get served. It may not be the same players all the time.
Yeah, Dave, if everything's at Oracle and IBM and Microsoft, I mean, how is there still not competition just because it's been digested?
Well, I mean, I guess there potentially is, but I mean, you have to think about it from the perspective of if you're a buyer, you can now only buy from four companies. Is that really what you want? Is that, you know, do you really think that these companies are innovating better than small companies? I mean, it's sort of like the Microsoft problem where all the cool stuff is going on around the edges. It's not going on at Microsoft, or the things that do don't get surfaced enough. Even the Yahoo, I was playing with the Yahoo Search Monkey thing yesterday. It's really cool. But what the hell are they going to do with that, right? A small company could have made that a much more interesting, more viable business and potentially offered more. Now, that's not to say that Yahoo can't do something with it, but I just think we've reached a point here of, like, no, stocks are not going to move. Everything is going to sit at the same level. There's only going to be so much choice for customers, and then we're going to have to wait another 10 years until there's another cycle of startups to come through.
You're just bleak because your job is hard and running a company is difficult. You need to get over this thing, man.
I was bleak. Yeah,
it's not true.
I was bleak.
It's not true it's not true that customers only buy from four companies. The four companies probably wish that were true, but it's not true. You know, the big guys are consolidating because it gives them more products to sell into their installed base, which drives revenues, which makes the street happy, which is good. But the companies that they buy are the little innovative guys that take outsized risks and fail in much greater proportion than they succeed, but the successors do really cool stuff. So I think that that's a law of nature, and that's going to continue to be true.
One interesting thing, and Dave, I don't know if you've seen this in your world, and Mike, there may not be much of a database market outside of the big companies at this point, but in the content management market, so just one market, every company in my market except for Alfresco and other open source, but we're all starting from a small base, so it kind of doesn't count at that point. But every single one of the non-consolidated vendors is struggling right now, is significantly struggling. And even Documentum, which is now part of EMC, their last earnings, where they kind of sort of broke it out. I think CMS Watch did a piece on it. They are starting to get hit as well. And I'm kind of wondering if there is any growth for companies, for applications, unless you're really small and so you've got a lot of headroom, for these bigger companies. I'm kind of wondering if there is any growth outside of one of these big consolidators. I don't know how Stellant's doing within Oracle, but I know that SharePoint's doing well with inside of Microsoft, and I'm guessing that we're going to see Vignette acquired, Interwoven acquired, just as we saw in the BI space, everybody be acquired. And maybe that is the only way, once you reach a certain stature, that's the only way to grow.
Well, it is.
Well, I think, first, a couple things I want to say. If you guys are hearing sirens in the background, I'm sorry, I'm in San Francisco, and that was me. I went on mute for a minute. You know, Matt, I think you make an important point. Growth is only available once you achieve scale if the market you're in is growing. And if there is a fixed size market for content management, then disruptive, innovative companies like Alfresco can come in from beneath and do dramatic things and grow dramatically. But the guys who dominate that market have a very hard time at growing. And the only way they can do that is to diversify. One way to diversify is go build new products. Another is to get acquired by a company with a large portfolio that allows you to be part of that diverse offering. And that's what consolidation's about.
Oh, I don't like how smart Mike is. It's kind of throwing me.
Yeah, let's get somebody stupid on the call.
Yeah, let's talk about the cloud. Huh?
You know, you guys, the only
cloud.
The only reason I'm here is because Terry Gross never calls.
What did you, Dave? You were on a tear about the cloud.
I got beat up last in our last podcast where that guy said I was changing my that I was somehow telling people that they were addicted to Gmail, but at the same time saying that enterprise apps are never going away, and I actually stand behind that. But I spent a bunch of time talking to all these cloud guys because it was Java 1 last week. We haven't commented on that, and there was both Mule and Alfresco booths at Java 1. And I hung out with your counterpart, Gavin, and we talked about the fact that Sun has all this stuff, and they don't really do anything with it. And what do they come out with is JavaFX, right? Meanwhile, the 3 days after Java 1, they come out with this Hydrazine thing, which is their supposed cloud notion, but fundamentally, the cloud is not working in the way it's supposed to, because all these companies are not trying to build, or I should say, are not building application platforms by which where you can just deploy things. What they're building is either data centers or grid computing or sort of half-assed things like the Google App Engine. And so I got a little bit bummed out about it. On the other side, we are addicted to the Gmail, Salesforce.com, and the Google Apps Premier has working just fine at this point. So I can't see any reason why I would want to bring something like that back internal. But on the other hand, I don't see a lot of this stuff that, you know, that you'll hear about Salesforce.com or whatever, these Apex things, just doesn't seem realistic to me in terms of the real enterprise users.
Amazon has, I think what you're talking about, I mean, those packages where you can get Linux with different kind of middleware stacked on.
You can get Linux. You can get Red Hat.
I thought they had like the next level. Maybe, but don't you think that's just kind of the next evolution? I mean, you want the guys to
roll
that out.
But right now it's just hosting. I mean, what those are just, it's just web hosting.
Right.
It's not like, you know, these are not multi-tenant whatever necessarily. And you can't just deploy an app and not have to know, for example, you know, even an IP address, or, you know, you still have to have a lot of knowledge about the platform that you're deploying to in the cloud. And really the idea is that you should not have to know that. It should all be basically virtual, or it should just be an instantiation of something that you're running locally where you can just basically, you know, transport it from one place to another.
Who can explain JavaFX? I mean, this is Sun trying to compete with Adobe and Microsoft and all the other kind of mobile software that's out there.
Yeah, wasn't it the Register who just slammed JavaFX, talking about how it's been promised for years and it's still being promised out into the future while everybody else sprints forward?
Yeah, it was. Schwartz took that really well.
I don't know that there's needs to be anything more said than that. I mean, Sun, I wish them well, but I just don't understand. I don't understand why they're doing it. To me, it's too little, too late.
We need to wait.
Mike says that he's got to drop off soon, so let's hear an intelligent thing from him. Any intelligent things that Mike wants to say, we should just let him throw them all out on the table.
Wait,
and
Mike,
we can.
Mike, before you go, I mean, what can you say anything about Oracle a little bit more now that you've left and kind of their approach to open source, or are you still forbidden?
No, I'm not forbidden. But I respect the company too much to try to speak for it from outside. I had a good time there. You guys know I've been positive in everything I've said publicly about the company. And that's because I feel pretty positively about the company on the inside. I think that Oracle is sophisticated and smart and has a whole lot of money. And those are a bunch of significant advantages. And, we'll see how things go. Certainly, open source is an important trend in the industry, both in developing software and in distributing it and getting in customers' hands. And that's having an effect on every single business everywhere. I think Oracle's acquisition of Sleepy Cat was driven in no small part by the fact that we had done some cool stuff with open source. I think you'll continue to see good stuff out of Redwood Shores around that. I think the company will continue to do smart things and to get more sophisticated.
What do you think the over-under is on them buying Red Hat if we set the mark at 2 years?
Okay, so they implanted a chip in my brain, and that chip says, that's not my area. However, you can contact investor relations.
See, they still have you, man.
As soon as you said that, I felt the tug in my brain.
All right, Mike. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We'll continue on and let you scamper off to your life.
Thank you. Don't slap me around when I'm off the air, guys. I'm going to listen to the podcast, and you better say only nice things.
Now we're stupid. Now I just feel dumb.
Hey, you guys, is Mike off? Mike is such an idiot. What was he talking about? He didn't know what he was talking about. That was pure crap. There we go. Oh, Mike's still there.
Bye-bye. Thank you, register readers.
Bye-bye.
Mike, see you later,
have
guys.
Have a nice time. Thanks. In your eating your exotic lunch of quail eggs and such while the rest of us poor people have sandwiches.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
All right, gentlemen, what do we have?
I'm eating quails right now.
Matt, I'm eating quail. Mike is having a bald eagle frappuccino as we speak.
What do we have left? I like this one. I think it was Matt. Does the open source community hate itself? Of course they
hate
do.
Matt, yeah. That's for sure.
Well, I think we need to – I've become increasingly frustrated with the self-appointed community over the last – well, it's been over the last year, although it came to a boil in this past week where I posted something pretty innocuous that says we should find ways to get more people contributing either cash or code. I wouldn't think that even Richard Stallman would necessarily have a problem with that. The problem, I think, is that I threw the word in free rider, and suddenly people like went ballistic saying, free rider, how dare you? Everybody contributes something, whether it's documentation or code or... And the reality is that, no, most people don't contribute anything. They contribute
British?
Exactly nothing. And in fact, a lot of people contribute the opposite, even more than nothing. They contribute an amplification of nothing by encouraging other people to give nothing as well.
Yep.
And it's just, I don't know. I mean,
well, this is the classic, isn't this the thing though, Matt, also of these are people who are commenting on this and crying about it are people who don't write software, who don't actually participate in the community in any way except for to talk shit and don't contribute code, they don't contribute money, they don't contribute anything of value, and yet they contribute
bile.
Yes. And, you know, to some extent, that's certainly fair, right? Everyone can do that, and that's sort of part of it. But, I mean, there is a point where you have to say, hey, look, I was in a fight with a guy on my blog, by the way, about a guy who was saying how I don't know anything about open source and how I don't know anything about Java and whatever else. And I said, well, what do? You're a crappy marketing consultant somewhere in Michigan. How are you somehow more qualified? I sponsor, and we have 5 or 6 projects beyond Mule that we pay for people to do development on.
Yeah, but Michigan is the epicenter of Michigan Ubuntu.
Oh, right. It's kind of frustrating and a little bit disconcerting but it's the same in everything. It's the same in politics. It's the same in your local community. A vocal minority, and usually an obnoxious minority, tends to make more noise than the herd. And the herd, and I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, the herd, or the average person, I should rather say, is the person at JP Morgan Chase or the person at Safeway or some other company that really likes open source, that cares actually a lot about it, and that probably more often than not is increasingly choosing open source solutions over non-open source solutions for net new projects. But that person doesn't profit at all by the bile that's spewed out there back and forth. And it's, I mean, because I spent the last three weeks out on the road meeting with customers, and none of the customers had any of this crap to say.
No.
I come back to my blog and I put something up there that's pretty, again, pretty innocuous, and it's how can we encourage more people to contribute? And I just, I get this flame fest, and some of these people that were flaming me are normally fairly rational people, and so I just couldn't understand why they were taking it so wrong.
There's that mix of sort of where some, you know, I think people have this, and I do too, where we always have this kind of struggle of open source versus free software, right? And I think what you were getting a lot of is people were misinterpreting these comments about open source always having to be free, and that's okay, and there's certainly an aspect of that, but it was interesting though, because that was one of the main thing that Jim Whitehurst said in his OSBC keynote was all about getting people to contribute code back. And that was like a great thing. And you know, and then all of a sudden you had the audacity to say it and everyone was slamming you for it. It was ridiculous. It's almost become like sports teams. You know, like how do you sort of do everything you can to defeat the Giants even though you're their biggest supporter, or like the guy who stole the ball out from when the Cubs almost lost, when they lost the World Series or whatever it was, right?
Mr. Berman.
I don't know. I don't follow a lot of sports.
I think it was Berman, wasn't it?
Your closet arms.
Yeah, but this also does speak a little bit to one of the other topics that we had, was this open source model in and of itself, and that I had Matt actually talk to somebody as a friendly gesture, where there's a company that I know where they're thinking about going open source. They really have no idea what to do. They're terrified of this idea of having to fight with the community or even deal with sort of the implications of having code out there, and it's still challenging for people. And the other note here is that I got to tell you, the licensing thing, even when you know about it, it remains a nightmare. That's one of the things that I think is still a hindrance for a lot of people.
So just as like an outsider, as far as the bile and stuff goes, I mean, is this really any different than when you have any kind of large organization of people going after anything? Like, I'm not sure what the
dynamics.
I just don't know what you guys want or it would expect.
Well, it's just weird. I mean, this one was weird because, you know, when you go against, so, you know, it's not hard to look back at 3 years of Matt's postings and say that this guy has been, if anything, so biased towards open source that it's, you know, ridiculous, that it does get a little bit weird when people start to accuse you of saying, oh no, you're completely wrong. How dare you ask for money for this?
But these are like
whatever.
The guys who,
how dare you ask for anything back?
You know, these are the guys who kind of like to hear themselves talk on message boards.
It may be a little bit different in the open source world because it's still, frankly speaking, a relatively small world, and so you know the people.
I mean
when you get screeched at by one of these bozos, you feel it maybe a little bit more poignantly than you would if you were at Oracle and, you know, you could have 50,000 people all yelling at you, telling you that they hate you, and in fact they do, and they're all your customers. but they still keep paying you. You're somewhat insulated, both by size and just by the fact that it's a big software world. Open source world is still pretty small, and I did this Google Trends. It was actually pretty illuminating for me anyway. Nobody's commented on the blog, so I'm assuming it was not illuminating for anybody else. But I looked at Google Trends data for open source, both in the news and in terms of people searching for it. Open source, Apple, Google, and Microsoft. And open source hardly even shows up on the graph. Whereas Google's almost off the charts, Apple's way up there, Microsoft's way up there. And so within this relatively small open source community, we really do. I mean, I think open source is one of the top two most important things that's happened to technology in the last 10, 20 years. But the average person out there on the street, the average IT person, and just average person in general, doesn't. It's maybe an important, they don't realize how important it is to their lives because it's embedded in all these other products that they're using for cheaper because the company started with an open source core or whatever. But the reality is open source does not consume as much attention as those of us who are in the industry think it should or does, because I mean it's an important thing. It's very important. I continue to think it's extremely important, but it's not worth screaming about.
Did you get just change in direction for a second? You guys both met with Jim Whitehurst, right, in the last couple of weeks. Anything interesting you can share?
I cannot confirm that MuleSource is about to be acquired by Red Hat.
Yeah, sadly,
that is not. That is an unconfirmed rumor. I will not confirm it.
I can confirm that it is not true.
Anything interesting come out, or same old?
Dave turned him down because he didn't want to limit customer choice.
I
said no consolidation.
Right. Yeah, I said Oracle is right. I can't do this. I've been impressed. I mean, no, from my perspective, I've been really impressed. I think he's a smart dude. I think he really sort of plays down just how savvy he really is. And I think that it'll be very interesting to see. My take is that he needs to go big. He needs to do some big stuff. And I don't know whether or not the rest of Red Hat believes that. So he certainly has the ability to do that. I have a funny story he told me that I could probably share about Mark Fleury.
Please do.
So Jim lives in Atlanta still, and then is on his way moving up there to North Carolina. And so he met Fleury for breakfast, and he said it was pretty late. It was like 9:30 or something like that. I'll exaggerate this, obviously, but that Fleury walked in, and Jim said he was kind of a mess. Like, you know, his hair was a mess, and he had like big sunglasses on. He was wearing like ripped jeans or whatever. And he's like, you know, what have you been doing, Mark? And he's like, oh man, I'm completely obsessed with PS3. And like, he just went on this like, for like 5 minutes talking about PS3, and Jim didn't realize he was actually talking about the video game, like the PS3 video game. And he said, you know, so it was like 10 or 15 minutes about how he had to solve Grand Theft Auto 3 because the new one was coming out that Wednesday, and how he was, you know, he was gearing up for it to stay up till midnight to go buy the video game.
So this is what happens after you get rich.
God damn, Mike Olson doesn't play video games. guy goes like scuba diving every day.
So that's so he can get in touch with his inner Mike.
Lives at Berkeley.
Well, fellas, in the interest of keeping these shows at a more digestible level, we might call it here unless somebody can wow me with something.
I had
else.
One other question. I don't know. I don't follow this as well, but is there a lot of video game startups? Anybody? Like, why are there not more? Is it just so difficult to monetize because it's like a hits business?
There are a lot of. There are actually a lot of games studios that we don't see because they produce crap. But I mean, as an example, you wouldn't think of Salt Lake City as a gaming center, but I can think of like six different game studios, one of which Microsoft bought a few years ago. I think there's actually a lot of it, but maybe because that industry has already been consolidated, they get consumed up into Activision, EA, Ubisoft, before you hear about them.
Dave, I think, I mean, basically it seems like you can do it, but then once you come out with a really strong game, somebody gobbles you up, you know? Because
I'm just curious.
The cost of doing the games. But you look at, like, Blizzard, they make World of Warcraft, and, you know, they're still on their own, I believe.
No, they're not.
Were they? Who?
Blizzard is not. They merged with Activision.
Oh, did they? Well, there. It's not my certainly not my field of expertise.
I only know that because Activision is a customer of Alfresco's, and we were talking about their joint infrastructure just last week.
Well, there you go. So that was it for me. I didn't have anything else. I've become fascinated by video games because we got a Wii in the office and we got Guitar Hero, and it's a little bit.
I didn't know that. Yeah. I would visit more often if I knew
it's,
that.
It's pretty. And one of Veronica, who works here, is fantastic at it and unlocked all the games. So unlocked all the songs, I should say. But I've been starting to wonder, like, how is it? Is a gaming company, like, do you have to raise like $100 million to go start a gaming company? Because you need the engine, and you need graphics, and you need an enormous amount of marketing, all those kinds of things. Like, is that why there's a big barrier to entry?
I don't know. Maybe our readers can help us out here. And
dear readers, and help us on this. We would like to make more video games.
Dave and I are making a stealth video game. We need your help distributing it, marketing it, and buying it.
And you start to wonder, like, does the open source model of sort of adoption and getting things into the hands, does that really matter in the video game things, or is it just sort of helpful? I was looking at the WiiWare. Have you seen that? It's like their next online gaming thing, but it's totally closed. Like, you can't create Wii games, for example, unless you have a license from Nintendo. and you can't then go sell them online, but there's a market, there's a place somewhere where you start to figure out a really big ecosystem around these. And the, you know, the dominant console, sorry, spazzing out here, I'm looking out the window, dominant gaming console has a bigger ecosystem than it did before.
Well, there you have
it. It's interesting.
There you have it, friends. If you can help us out on the, with your gaming expertise, we'd appreciate it. As always, send your feedback to ashley.vance@theregister.co.uk or software@theregister.com or .co.uk, whatever you prefer. And we'd like to thank Mike for being on the show, and thank you guys, as always.
Yeah, I didn't have much to do.
And we'll see you here shortly.